partially withdrawn from Wadi Gaza as part of the ceasefire agreement of January 15, 2025 that finally went into effect on January 19th. True to their duplicitous nature, the Zionists have constantly violated its terms. With the resumption of attacks on Gaza, killing innocent Palestinian women and children, and relaunching the ground invasion, the Zionists have once again proved that they do not abide by any agreement. They are habitual liars and serial killers. All humanitarian food deliveries to Gaza were blocked, again in clear violation of the first phase of the agreement, exacerbating an already critical food situation. This was followed by cutting off electricity to Gaza, whose infrastructure has been completely destroyed during 15 months of relentless Israeli regime bombings. The January agreement also stipulated that Israel will allow tents as temporary shelter for the traumatized people until the enclave is rebuilt. True to their non-compliance and duplicitous nature, they have allowed only a small number of tents into Gaza. The reconstruction of Gaza remains an elusive dream. The U.S. Zionist plan is to ethnically cleanse the tiny strip of its 2 million inhabitants so that Trump and his equally greedy son-in-law, Jared Kushner, can build their Riviera of the Middle East on the Gaza beachfront. For Netanyahu, an ethnically cleansed enclave will mean that illegal Zionist squatters can move in there and steal even this small patch of Palestinian land. Trump's demonic plan calls for pushing the Palestinians into Egypt and Jordan. Rulers in both countries have categorically rejected the idea. They seek the risk of an influx of such a large number of Palestinians, inspired by the Islamic spirit of resistance, into their countries. They fear the Palestinians might radicalize their already angry populations and overthrow these regimes. Trump has also floated other ideas, equally bizarre, about throwing the Palestinians out of Gaza and dumping them in East Africa, Somalia, for instance, or even pushing them into Syria. There is, of course, a much simpler solution to this ongoing problem that erupted with the illegal intrusion of Zionist thieves and bandits from Europe and North America into Palestine. They should return to the countries from which they came: Poland, Romania, Ukraine, Hungary, Serbia, Russia, and North America, the United States and Canada. These racists and bigots do not belong in the Holy Land of Palestine that has been drenched in the blood of innocent Palestinian people since the arrival of these mass murderers in 1947 to 1948. Let us consider why Trump is so beholden to the pro-Israel lobby. It is not merely because Kushner is Jewish, or that his daughter Ivanka has also converted to Judaism. Religion has little relevance for Trump. He is driven by greed, a trait he shares with most Americans, and he is extremely narcissist. These, however, do not fully explain his subservience to the Zionists. There are several other possible reasons. First, Jewish donors to his election campaign are in the forefront. Miriam Adelson and her late husband, Sheldon Adelson, have contributed massive amounts for the specific purpose of getting Trump to fulfill their demands regarding Israel. Miriam Adelson's $100 million contribution to Trump's campaign was made on the condition that, if elected, the Orange Man will allow Israel's annexation of the illegally occupied West Bank. The Adelson's donations, actually bribes, made to Trump's campaign in 2016 were to get him to recognize Al-Quds as the capital of Israel and to relocate the U.S. embassy there. Trump complied. For their massive contributions to his campaign, Trump awarded Miriam Adelson a Presidential Medal of Freedom in December 2018. In fairness to the Adelsons, they have donated large sums to other right-wing politicians as well. Politicians they supported and had virtually in his pocket included George W. Bush, John McCain, Newt Gingrich, Mitt Romney, and even the certified crook Rudy Giuliani. Over the course of the 2020 election cycle alone, Adelson gave more than $420 million to conservative candidates and political groups. Greg Palast helpfully tells us in his 2016 book, America Has the Best Democracy Money Can Buy, A Tale of Billionaires and Ballot Bandits. The other, more plausible explanation is that Trump had close ties to the pedophile and Mossad agent Jeffrey Epstein. It is widely believed that Epstein made videos of Trump having relationship with minors and gave these to Israeli intelligence for blackmail purposes. Habitual blackmailers, the Zionists, may have threatened to release these videos and ruin his presidency if he does not comply with their demands. Even in a sex-plagued society like the United States of America, certain details may prove embarrassing even for a dirty old orange man. The price is being paid by hapless Palestinians.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of the Cradle News Roundup, your one-stop shop for all news West Asia. My name is Esteban Carrillo. I am the news editor for The Cradle. And as usual, I'm joined by my colleagues, content creator and writer for The Cradle, Karim Shami, and content creator and social media manager for The Cradle, Sima Itayim. So as just to get into Yemen a bit, because I don't want us to go too long into it, but Yemen has become the target of the U.S. War, of these very intense attacks that have been happening. We talked about it last week. Again, we know this is not going to resolve at the end of a gun, but there's also Iraq, right? Like, Iraq is also been starting to get pressure to dismantle the PMU and all of these factions from Israel. But as Karim often puts it, right, Iraq is just going to do whatever he's told. And then at the end of the list is Iran, right? With the letter from Trump to Khamenei and the threats that are continuing. We heard a few months ago that Israel was planning to launch attacks on Iran with the U.S. help in 6 months, right? They said by the fall, right? So, again, none of us here have a crystal ball, sadly, but the way things are going, it does seem like this has kind of become the status quo, right? And I think one of the places that you can see it clearly clearest is in Lebanon, where, again, the Israeli occupation army has continued to launch attacks, killing several people just over this weekend in the south, in the east of Lebanon, threatening to expand attacks on Beirut again, obviously threatening the airport, obviously threatening the usual things that they do, civilians, and the United States standing right behind them, saying, you know, we are willing to give you a freedom of action. At the same time, talking with the Lebanese leaders who are scrambling to put a stop to this in any way. But I feel like in Gaza, like in the West Bank, you as an Arab can do what you want, to protect your people. But at the end of the day, if the biggest, the most powerful empire in history is standing behind this genocidal, suicidal nation that is on a warpath, I don't think there's much that you can do, right? And I feel very concerned about what may come next for Lebanon, because now we're hearing, you know, over the weekend there was a rocket attack that was launched from Lebanese soil into the Metula settlement in Israel, and this was used to expand the air campaign. And then we were hearing some reports say that Israel may be trying to essentially do a false flag, right, justify dropping bombs in Beirut and just expanding their aggression, because at the end of the day, they want us to roll over. They want everyone to roll over to tap out and just to say, okay, we will normalize with you. But at what cost, right? And who is willing to do it? What do you guys think about what's happening in Lebanon, about this escalation? Because it's been coming from Syria as well, not just from Israel.
Karim, before I let you go, I mean, it's a one-sided war. Lebanon's under constant attack. We saw attacks yesterday in the south that killed, a citizen. And by the way, guys, just pointing it out there, if someone is in Hezbollah but is not in combat, then it is a civilian. So I just wanted to make that clear to anybody.
These are the rules of war, right?
To anyone who was confused about that. So, you know, your stuff doesn't fly with me. Anyway, so we had like very, very, very brutal strikes. They started before this thing happened, where on Saturday, 5 primitive rockets were launched at the Israeli settlement of Umtalle or Metula. And in response, Israel unleashed a heavy wave of airstrikes, like very heavy, on both southern and eastern Lebanon. And Hezbollah, which typically claims responsibility for its operations, denied involvement in this rocket fire. I mean, if you see the photo of the rocket launches, you'll know it's not Hezbollah. I mean, I think it's just agents working for Israel trying to give them excuse. But they don't need an excuse. Again, they don't need an excuse, so not so sure. Israel claimed to have targeted, of course, Hezbollah infrastructure, including command centers and rocket sites, and the death toll is at least 8 people. And of course, they're saying they're doing this to protect their civilians. And of course, the Lebanese state has remained completely silent. You know, no condemnation.
Really?
Yeah, no statements. Oh, you're being sarcastic.
Breaking news.
No, just silence. You know, for the South, it's like, of course, once again, all these decades later, nothing has changed. The South is treated as though it's not a part of Lebanon. It's totally neglected. And to make matters worse, since the truce was signed in November, you know, Israel's reported it has violated the ceasefire not 1,000 times, not 1,500 times, but thousands of times. Mm-hmm. And, of course, continues to occupy these new 5 strike positions. And Hezbollah has intentionally taken a step back. Hezbollah is not in a great place, is it? Heavily targeted, not given a moment to breathe. Even its newer leaders that have been recently appointed are being targeted one by one. Anyway, Hezbollah has given the Lebanese government and army space to act, standing behind the army and allowing the state a chance to rise to the occasion. But let's be honest, that's leading nowhere. So we are under a one-sided war. And again, it's like, oh, thank you to the government for working to make sure that Beirut won't be hit. Because the south isn't a part of Lebanon. We should only worry if Beirut is hit, right? And anyway, this is Lebanon without the resistance, you know? It's a Lebanon that plays into Israel's hands and that seeks complete inaction over justice at any price and, of course, bends to external pressure. Can't even muster up a statement to condemn strikes on its own land.
Currently in Lebanon and previously, and before even the assassination of Sayyid Hassan, Lebanon is either black or white. There is no gray part. You are either with Israel or against Israel. That's it. Previously, the majority or the power that Hezbollah possessed prevented the government to take some decisions such as normalizing, and that's it. And they didn't use their power internally at all. Currently, the power has shifted, but the people are still the same. And the people that believe in retaliation and resistance are still the same percentage as before the assassination of Sayyid Hassan. But what happened now is that the power inside the government shifted, and now the people that are against Hezbollah are acting as if they were the people who fought Hezbollah, and they are taking decisions against Hezbollah as if they are the ones who won. Just to let you know how much the Israelis they are. They are not even Zionist. Zionist is like a very beautiful word for them. They are Israelis. There's no difference. I think they will push for everything And even the Israelis will tell them, khalas, stop, as what happened last month. If you know Arabic and you're following the Lebanese journalists that are aligned with Israel and Saudi Arabia, you will see that they were pushing for normalizations in the media with Israel, and they are preparing the masses. They are saying, if not this week, next week. And now when you go to the streets in Lebanon, you will see, I think that normalization is before the summer. The new school year, you will have normalization.
Mm-hmm.
And the funny part is that the Israelis went out and said, no, we don't want normalization now because we have parts of your country. We don't want to make a new borders with Lebanon. We are happy as we are.
Yes.
And after that, the journalists and the people that go to the TVs, they stop talking about normalization because Israel told them, no, that's not now,
babies. That's not what we want.
Talk about something else. So, in short, there's either black or white in Lebanon. You're either with or against Israel. If you're with Israel, currently you are pushing the narrative of the United States and the Israelis and the Saudi Arabians that everything is blamed on Hezbollah.
Indeed, Lebanon really is, between a rock and a hard place. It's a
country. By the way, there's a drone. There's a drone now. It came back. It's hovering above Beirut. It's really loud.
That's been the status quo.
For the Lebanese army?
No. It's an Israeli drone.
We saw the Lebanese Air Force a few days ago when they bombed Syria with their World War II planes. Sadly, that is, again, the status quo that nations need to heal, nations need to be bowed, against the occupier, against the genociders, right?
By the way, guys, this is Hossam. He was only 22 years old. You know him. This is the Al Jazeera correspondent, Hossam Shabbat. So, yeah, he was born in 2001. He's the second journalist they killed today, like within a span of less than 3 hours.
It's been 208 journalists killed.
208, maybe
209
now.
We saw, it was one of the NGOs that track attacks against journalists that said a few months ago that the biggest cause of death for journalists in war zones for the past year and a half has been the Israeli army. So again, this is kind of what has become normal, right? And just to finish my thought about what I want to say about Lebanon is that Lebanon needs billions to reconstruct for the damage that it has already incurred by the attacks, by the Israeli attacks, by the U.S.-backed war. This is money that is being offered, right, by the IMF, by the World Bank, by the Saudis, by the Qataris, etc., by the U.S., I guess. And everything's conditioned. Everything's conditioned, and more likely than not conditioned on normalization. And as you guys said, more likely as Ghassan Kanafani said, right, the neck does not negotiate against the sword. And sadly, that is exactly the position that Lebanon finds itself in. But we will continue to discuss this as the weeks go on. I want us to move to Turkey, a nation we don't often discuss on its own, but that has warranted discussion over recent days because a huge protest broke out across Turkey, several cities, following the arrest of Istanbul Mayor Ekrem İmamoğlu. Over 1,100 people arrested as of this recording, including 9 journalists. İmamoğlu, a prominent figure in Turkish politics and Recep Tayyip Erdogan's main rival, who could be considered, possibly the next president of Turkey in the upcoming elections in 2028, by the way. So Erdogan really acting way ahead of time to jail his competitors. Turkey at this point finds itself in a very interesting position following the fall of Syria, right? And they seem to have consolidated a lot of power, a lot of importance, in particular, as NATO members. They are in a way the keepers of Syria, no? Of the ISIS government that is currently governing there. And also, an interesting report that I want to mention is that last week the EU, a report comes out last week saying that the EU is apparently reconsidering allowing Turkey into the Union, right, to allow Turkey to become a full EU member. Why? Because they need a new arms dealer. They need to start buying weapons from someone else because now we know that Europe is on a desperate rush to start arming themselves for their, inevitable war with Russia now that the United States has essentially left them, standing out in the cold on their own. So all of a sudden, being friendly with Turkey seems to be the correct move for them. So, you know, I just want to give that context to why, right, we are seeing essentially the breakdown of any, you know, democratic pretenses that may have existed in the former Ottoman Empire, to now become more of a, you know, only Erdogan can be in power, only Erdogan can protect our interests, only Erdogan can move forward. So what have you guys heard, what have you guys seen about what's been happening in Turkey?
First, to be honest, I'm not that professional in Turkey issues, internal issues, but of course we all saw what happened. We saw that the mayor of Istanbul. Was detained, and yesterday he was jailed. Yani they jailed him on
officially, yes.
Yeah, officially jailed. And we know that the mayor in Istanbul, he was elected by the people of Istanbul. And this is a big difference. Yani in our region or in Lebanon, for instance, usually mayors are appointed. But he was elected. That means that the people elected him and they love him for the city. That's why we saw many people went to the streets. But the background story, I read many things. And some people say that because he was... He had his education in Cyprus, and it was revoked. And with him, like 106 people were also their education was revoked. But the point is that, as you said, it's of course it's political. Yeah, if he was from his party, this won't happen, and we all know this.
If he was from the AKP, right? That's Erdogan's party.
So, and the point is that I don't know his ideology. Yani maybe both him and Erdogan is good for the country or bad for the Turkey, but we discuss here what's good and bad for the region. I don't know the stance of the mayor of Istanbul. Do you know about him? Do you know? Yani he's good with Iran. He's good with the United States. He's good with Israel. Yeah, we have to know this before.
I would imagine he's not, you know, a very pro-resistant character.
I don't know, but what's happening here now currently in Turkey, as I see it, as a person who's not like too much into Turkey, this either will make Erdogan the ultimate leader for maybe at least one decade or two decades to come, or it will weaken him. We have to wait and see. And we know that Turkey now has like foots in many places in Libya. If Erdogan is weakened, because this is Erdogan's policy, I don't think this is the policy of Turkey. We have to differentiate this. And of course, Syria will be weakened if he's weakened. Or if he gets the full power, then he can do whatever he wants in Syria, in Qatar, in Libya. We have to wait and see.
Well, like, just to give a bit of a rundown in case there's anyone watching who has no idea. So he was, formally arrested yesterday on corruption charges, but also was previously detained for not only corruption, but terror links, you know, to the PKK. So the court accuses him of everything from embezzlement to rigging bids to unlawful data collection. And he called this, like, unimaginable slander. And he put out all these things on social media, like, I will never bow down and we will get through this and whatever. So initially, before yesterday, he was like formally arrested yesterday. So he was detained in a dawn raid earlier this week, just as his party, which is the CHP, began endorsing him as a 2028 presidential candidate. So, you know, the timing, you know, says a lot. And so, as you guys mentioned, his university diploma was revoked the day before his arrest. So this sparked what we can safely call the largest street protests in Turkey in over a decade across the country, and they were defying a four-day protest ban that the government enforced. They enforced a protest ban, and of course we saw riot police with tear gas and pepper spray and all that, and you mentioned the mass detentions. But so the point is, many analysts, including those who work with us here at the Cradle, see this as a political purge, you know, of course not a legal process. You know, it's an attempt by him to remove his strongest political rival, I guess, you know, ahead of the election. Because this guy is not, he's more than a mayor. He's like a national symbol of political hope for
because
many Turks.
When he's elected for Istanbul mayor, he defeats Erdogan's candidate, right? The CHP defeats the AKP candidate by like 20,000 votes. And some backroom maneuvering by the governing party in Turkey, which, by the way, Erdogan has been president for 23 years in Turkey. They rerun the election, right? They do it again, and then the second time he wins by almost a million votes, right? So if anything, this maneuvering, this sort of persecution works in his favor. And I would imagine down the line, it's probably going to continue to work in his favor after what happened last week. What I want to bring up to attention, right, is the parallels of what happened, what Erdogan has done over the past week with İmamoğlu, with what happened with Imran Khan in Pakistan, right? When this very popular prime minister is removed from office in a legislative coup, sent to prison, given dozens of charges on everything, right? Just buried in legal cases, him and his wife thrown in jail, his party is persecuted, his followers are persecuted. It becomes a war, right? In Turkey, it becomes a war against the PTI, if I'm not mistaken, that's Khan's party. In Turkey, it seems to be the same a playbook in a way, and because that's the empire playbook, right? This is what happens. This is what lawfare is. This is how you persecute leaders when you don't want to go into a country with marching, with troops, or you don't have an ISIS, or you don't have, you don't want to launch airstrikes and start killing people. You use lawfare. That's what happened in Brazil. That's what happened in Ecuador. That's what happened in Argentina. That's what happened in Pakistan. That's what happens, everywhere. It's been happening everywhere for many, many years. It's just, I think, again, this idea that Erdogan is their guy, right? He's the guy. He's the guy who brought down Assad. He's the guy who's friendly with Israel, who's friendly with Azerbaijan. He's the one that is wanting to kind of combat Iranian influence, right? He wants Turkish influence in West Asia, to overtake whatever is left of Iranian influence. And here's actually what's interesting and what I want to hear your guys' thought about it, because Walla News, this Israeli news outlet, a few days ago comes out with this incredibly interesting report that says that Israeli officials are talking about a confrontation between Turkey and Israel in Syria being inevitable, and that there's preparations going, right, to essentially be a war between Israel and Turkey, which, by the way, Israel and Turkey, they're allies. They've been allied for the longest time. Erdogan and Netanyahu, two peas in a pod. Erdogan will give the loudest speeches about Netanyahu being a Nazi and a Hitler and whatever else. But then there's actually no attempts to break relations, to cut the gas that flows through Turkish pipelines to Israel, to end that trade. Remember when he poses the trade ban and then immediately a few days later starts giving waivers for companies to continue doing trade with Israel. And we have reports at the Cradle about how the trade has essentially not slowed down. If anything, it has increased since the start of the genocide in Gaza. So do you guys think there's any validity, right? Because let's just remember that Israel has been essentially one of the only countries in the world that has been referring to the Syrian government, the current de facto government in Syria, as an al-Qaeda government, as a terrorist government. And they say it too, that they are supported by Turkey, which is, yes, factual, it is. They're completely supported by Turkey. They are, propped up by Erdogan. Is Israel going to go to war with Turkey in Syria?
Not war. I mean, there may be a Turkish threat.
On social media, they will fight on social media.
100%. Remember yesterday what I boasted about the Channel 12 correspondent, that he was saying that this is like just a distraction. Basically, like Netanyahu has directed the Israeli media to make it seem like Israel's gearing up for a war with Turkey. And this is to distract from, all the internal crises and to be able to continue maybe, everything else that he's doing. So we have a feature. We'll put it up on the screen by Mohammed Hassan Sweidan from a few days ago, called The Battle Between Greater Israel and Neo-Ottomanism in Syria. So it gives a perspective on the kind of clashing interests between Israel and Turkey in Syria. But, I mean, even through this analysis, a war does not seem likely at all. Karim, go ahead.
Yeah, just maybe people will not understand how is that. How they are talking like this, and there's like institutions who are saying that it's the war is coming between the two. If you read Egyptian or Jordanian newspapers, you will think that the King of Jordan tomorrow will go and like behead Netanyahu, and that al-Sisi will go and like drown the whole Israeli population.
I hope but you will place the picture of King Abdullah with the gun. He's cosplaying.
Yeah. So that's it. The media and what these politicians talk is very different of what's happening on the ground. not only Sisi. Before Sisi, we had Morsi, and we had before Morsi, we had Hosni Mubarak. Especially during Hosni Mubarak, there was, I think, four wars between, or not wars, we can say four aggressions from Israel on Gaza. And in the four wars, Hosni Mubarak refused to open the borders or to accept even people to like get medical care in Egypt. And Sisi, it's the same. Sisi is more smart, I think, because Sisi blamed Israel. He said, oh, look, we wanted to take them, but Israel didn't open the border. Although everybody knows that that Egypt has the authority over Gaza. It's like signed. There's a signed agreement that they have the authority. They can take people in and like open the border, but he didn't. So it's the same.
I just one idea about Israel and Turkey that like maybe this will put things into perspective is, you know, Israel, when there is an existential threat to Israel, Israel will set out to destroy its enemies. In the case of Turkey, there will be no war because there is no existential threat from Turkey. There's competition, and there is like, oh, they might be jeopardizing the current like is what Israel wants its regional dominance to look like, because Israel wants total dominance over the region.
To go back to the beginning of the discussion, right? At this point, Israel has reopened three fronts. They have opened the front again in Gaza, the front in Lebanon, and the front in Yemen, right? Even though the front in Yemen is not being fought directly by Israel yet, it's being just fought by the United States. Before we finish for this week, I just want to get your thoughts on like, what is next for Yemen? What can Yemen do next that they haven't done already, right? Because they have already, since the expansion of this war, they have been targeting the U.S. warships, the USS Truman. They have declared Ben-Gurion Airport in Tel Aviv unsafe for travel. They say they were going to continue to launch attacks. They've launched, if I'm not mistaken, at least two Palestine 2 missiles, the hypersonic ballistic missiles towards Israel. Both of them, I believe, shot down. But they're on. At this point, they're on their own, right? I heard also that one of their missiles, the fire actually fell in Saudi Arabia. So, what is next? What is next for Yemen?
As I said last time, Esteban, I think, and people got angry in the comments because I said it, but I think, unless they take footage from a drone or whatever, or a footage is leaked that they targeted a U.S. ship, okay, as if nothing is happening in the Red Sea. We only hear the news. And you too. You see that the Yemeni says that we targeted this ship, and then the Americans will have a counter post on Twitter say that they downed the drones or the ships or the cruise missiles. Unless there's visual evidence that this is happening, I think that's it, as if they are doing nothing in the Red Sea. But of course, they are... Yani some of course the Israeli shipping companies are in pain because they are really targeting them.
And to your point, Karim, about you know, we need footage. I think the biggest victories that Yemen achieved since the start of the genocide in Gaza were, first of all, the taking of the Galaxy Leader, right? This action movie footage of them landing on the ship, incredible stuff. And the other one was the drone that Sima made reference to, which again also had the footage, the social media video of the drone flying in from the beach in Tel Aviv, completely unopposed. So I don't know, we'll have to wait and see, because like I think the title of the last week's videos was very, you know, appropriate, the unfinished wars, because this is really like all of this is just gonna continue. I know some of it is falling out of the news cycle. We haven't even discussed about the persecution that you know, anti-genocide protesters are facing in the U.S., in Europe, in other Western nations, the deportations, etc. We haven't talked about Mahmoud Khalil. So many things happening right now, and they're all the repercussion of what? Of allowing a rogue state to continue committing a genocide under the noses of the entire world.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. today's lesson, Our Life is for Allah. Bismillah Rahman Rahim. Welcome to Ed Said with me, Sister Zainab, and IB English Radio. And obviously the title, Our Life is for Allah, and this is this seems very obvious to say that. But I'm going to sort of try and just demonstrate it with the example of a very famous martyr from the Holy Defense, Shahid Mustafa Chamran. So he in particular was very attuned and sensitive to the suffering of others. And so he had had a very easy and happy life, enjoyed all the material benefits in America. Then he abandoned it all and he went to South Lebanon. And he was actually living among the deprived. But what he would, for example, say, so he would actually say that he wanted to be among them. And he would say that if he couldn't help the oppressed, he should live like them and accept their pain and sorrow in his heart. And so this idea that, there's this serving others, wanting to be among others, and just in a sense wanting to do nothing but helping the oppressed, helping the poor, helping the disenfranchised. So in a sense to try to stop the suffering. So fighting against oppression, fighting against suffering, relieving oppression, obviously to the extent that human beings can, because obviously ultimately we know that everything does come from Allah, but obviously we must keep striving and doing our bit. And obviously this is how Martyr Mustafa Chamran understood his role was to be with the people, to help the people. And obviously this is a life that is for Allah. And obviously this is something I say again and again, that serving Allah is also expressed in serving others. Welcome back. This is A to Z and RB English Radio, and obviously I'm talking about serving others and serving Allah by serving others, and I've referred to the famous martyr Mustafa Chamran, who left his sort of what we call cushy or easy life in the US to go to the South Lebanon, and then obviously afterwards he went back to Iran. And so he understood his role in life as helping so working towards stopping oppression, stopping suffering. And, you know, obviously, so the question is, what can we do? And before we even get to the stage of the actions, what can we do? Maybe we need to ask ourselves, well, how do we need to think? Because, you know, we hear this a lot. This is not just from Islam. You know, sort of non-Islamic sources tell us that, you know, we must first change our mindset. And obviously we know that in Islam, it's all about the mindset. When we change the way we think, the way we phrase our intention, then obviously the correct actions will flow from that. So what do I mean? What is the mindset we need to sort of develop or nurture in us? So obviously we need to understand that we as Muslims, we're not on our own. The whole Ummah, and beyond that, all of humanity, we are sort of a one body. We're all tied together. And obviously we are told, for example, the Hadiths tell us that, or the Holy Prophet said, that obviously, if we wake up one day and we're not concerned for how the rest of how other Muslims are faring in the world, then, well, what should we be calling ourselves? I'm not going to express that. But, you know, this is something the Holy Prophet said. So we need to be... we need to hold ourselves to very high standards. We really need to have that concern for others. And this is obviously a mindset of compassion towards others and understanding that even though our life might be relatively easy, there are others who are suffering. And so obviously that's where we then need to think, well, what can we do? Is there any actions, any particular things that we can do to... relieve, to contribute towards ending that suffering or that oppression. So inshallah, this gives you maybe just some food for thought, and I look forward to welcoming you to another episode of A to Z here on IB English Radio, and farewell for now. thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
What about you? IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte has given reassurances there are no plans for a sudden drawdown of American military forces from Europe. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Financial Times has covered the story and tells us more. The United States has no plans for a sudden withdrawal from Europe's defense, NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte has emphasized, adding that any shift towards Asia would be coordinated with European allies. Mark Rutte's comments on Thursday, 3rd of April, come amid rising concern among European capitals about Washington's long-term commitment to the European continent's security. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio told his European counterparts on Thursday, 3rd of April, that President Donald Trump supports NATO but wanted allies to commit to a realistic pathway for them to take on more responsibility for NATO's capabilities. Mark Rutte told reporters ahead of a meeting of alliance foreign ministers that there are no plans for them to all of a sudden draw down their presence here in Europe. But we know that for America, being the superpower they are, they have to attend to more theaters. Mark Rutte added, "We do everything in this alliance in the spirit of no surprises, of working together. If the Americans want to pivot more to Asia, obviously we will do that in a coordinated fashion." Donald Trump's move to restore ties with Moscow and his threats to withdraw U.S. protection for NATO allies who failed to spend more on defense have spooked European governments, who have responded by increasing military investments and discussing how they would mitigate the United States reducing its support for the European alliance. Marco Rubio said he wanted to hear allies commit to increasing defense spending drastically, with a new target of 5% of gross domestic product or GDP, up from 2% at present, to build up their military capabilities as Washington seeks to scale back its presence in Europe and refocus on other regions of the globe. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio, standing next to NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte, said, "President Trump has made it clear we support NATO and we will remain in NATO. He's not against NATO. He's against a NATO that does not have the capabilities that it needs." Rubio added, "No one expects you will be able to do this in 1 year or two, but the pathway must be there. We do want to leave here with an understanding that we are on the pathway, a realistic pathway, to every single one of the members committed and fulfilling a promise to reach up to 5% of spending." He said, "That includes the United States." The U.S. Secretary of State dismissed reports of a possible reduction in U.S. troops or military presence in Europe as hysteria and hyperbole, but said the content needed to change its spending priorities. Marco Rubio added, This is a collection of advanced economies, rich countries who have the capability to do more. He also stressed that that would require a change from European governments after decades of building up vast social safety nets. Euronews has also covered the same story and tells us more. The U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio has reassured allies that Donald Trump is not anti-NATO and that the country will remain within the NATO alliance. But he's also asking his counterparts in Europe to make sacrifices and raise defense spending to 5% of GDP or gross domestic product. America's Secretary of State Marco Rubio has reassured NATO allies of U.S.'s commitment to the military transatlantic alliance at his first meeting of NATO foreign affairs ministers. Rubio recalled Donald Trump's message that the European countries and Canada need to further increase their defense spending. Rubio told reporters in Brussels, Belgium, the United States President Donald Trump made clear he supports NATO, and we're going to remain in NATO. He also stressed that the U.S. wants the alliance to be stronger against any potential threats. He said the only way NATO can get stronger and more reliable is if our partners, the nation states that comprise this important alliance, have more capabilities. The top U.S. diplomat said he expects to leave Brussels with a clear commitment from allies to spend 5% of their gross domestic product, or GDP, on defense, an increase from the current 2% of the GDP, which some European countries such as Belgium, Italy, and Spain still fail to meet. Rubio said, "I understand there's domestic politics after decades of building up vast social safety net that maybe don't want to take away from and that invest more in national security. But a full-scale ground war in the heart of Europe is a reminder that hard power is still necessary as a deterrent." Marco Rubio's comments come after Donald Trump said last month that the U.S. would not defend its European allies unless they increase their burden sharing within the NATO alliance. "It's common sense, right?" Donald Trump told reporters in the Oval Office in early March. "If they don't pay, I'm not going to defend them." The transatlantic alliance is currently assessing its capability gaps before committing to a new defense spending target, but a final figure is not expected until the annual NATO summit in June at The Hague in Netherlands. NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte stressed that European NATO members have recently committed to the largest increase in defense spending since the end of the Second World War, though he agreed with the United States that much more needs to be done. The former Dutch Prime Minister and NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte said, "It's my assumption that what we need to spend, the Canadians and Europeans together, will be north of 3%. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio stressed that raising defense spending to 5% of GDP cannot be done in 1 year or two. But the U.S. now demands a real way forward from its allies to build a stronger NATO capable of defending its territories. The NATO chief also warned that the global security threats facing the alliance are increasingly interconnected, and that the Russian threat will persist for many years to come. The NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte said, "We're seeing what China is doing. We're seeing how these two theaters, the Inner Pacific and the Euro-Atlantic, are getting more and more connected by the fact that the Russians are working together with the North Koreans and with the Chinese. So we have to look at all these theaters in conjunction, and that will be our focus." European NATO members are also expecting clear messages or a roadmap from U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio regarding the U.S. withdrawal of troops from Europe, where around 100,000 American soldiers are stationed. However, the U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio has not yet addressed the issue, and Mark Rutte indicated that no immediate drawdown of U.S. forces from Europe is planned. He said there are no plans for the U.S. military to all of a sudden withdraw from Europe, but we know that for America being the superpower, they have to attend to more theaters than one. Some NATO member states consider that the United States could reduce its presence by some 20,000 troops to 50,000 troops. NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte acknowledged that the U.S. has long sought to pivot its ascension towards the Indo-Pacific region, but assured that it will be done in a very coordinated manner.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
For today, you will listen to the English translation of a part of the text of the message delivered by Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Nowruz, the start of the Iranian New Year on March 20th, 2025. This year, too, our main issue remains the economy. Thus, my expectations from our esteemed government, respected officials, and our dear people once again centers around economic issues. This year's slogan will once again focus on economic matters, specifically investment in the economy. One of the important issues in the country's economy is investments in production. Production experiences a surge when investments are made. Of course, investments should primarily be made by the people. The government must find various methods for these to be done. But in cases where people either lack the motivation or the means to invest, the government can step in, not in competition with the people, but as a substitute. In instances where the people don't get involved, the government can enter the field and invest. In any case, investment in production is essential for both the country's economy and also for solving people's problems in livelihood. Improving people's livelihood needs planning and cannot happen without the source of preliminary measures. It's essential that both the government and the people seriously pursue and follow through the investments for production with firm resolve and motivation. The government's role is to create the necessary environment and remove obstacles to production. The people's role is to invest both small and large investments for the purpose of production. If capital is directed toward production, it will no longer be diverted into the harmful activities such as buying gold, purchasing foreign currency, or other such endeavors. Harmful activities will stop. The central bank can play a role in this regard, and the government can also implement many effective measures. With this in mind, this year's slogan is Investments for Production, which will help to improve people's livelihoods, God willing. The government's planning, in collaboration with the participation of the people, will together, God willing, solve the problem.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. I want to thank you for bringing me home.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The streets of Palestine fell silent on Monday. In a unified response, Palestinian factions announced a general strike in all Palestinian territories and refugee camps abroad. The move comes in protest at Israel's nonstop assault on Gaza. The factions describe the strike as a collective message to the international community, a demand to halt what they call a systematic genocide. Since October 7, 2023, Israel's military campaign has left over 165,000 Palestinians killed or wounded. The vast majority of them are women and children.
It's crucial for Palestinians to take to the streets. This catastrophe affects all of us, from Gaza to the northern West Bank, with attacks happening everywhere. If we expect the world to act, we must lead the way.
Shops, schools, public institutions, and private businesses closed their doors, echoing the grief and the resistance of the people under siege.
The horrors we're witnessing are unbearable. These crimes demand daily action, not seasonal outrage. The attacks are escalating. Nothing is spared. The crime is massive, and silence is even worse.
From historic uprisings to citywide shutdowns, the general strike remains a powerful tool of resistance.
Today's strike carries key messages: rejecting the genocide, calling on Palestinians everywhere to support Gaza, boycotting Israeli goods, and urging the world to end its silence. Today the war's in Palestine, tomorrow it will extend to other countries. This must stop.
It's time for the people to have a voice and take action. Today marks the beginning, and we will continue until the war on Gaza and the northern West Bank end.
With refugee camps across Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan, and other supporting countries joining in, the voice of the streets is powerful, and the pain of Gaza has reached unbearable levels.
The empty streets and stores here sends a clear message. One is to Gaza that the pain enduring by Palestinians is the same. The other message is for the world that the time has come for a firmer move to stop Israeli crimes. Naqa Ahmed, Ramallah, Occupied West Bank.
U.S. President Donald Trump released a video claiming success in targeting what he described as a meeting of higher-ranking military officials. According to Trump, those struck were allegedly coordinating upcoming naval operations, a move he hailed as a strategic victory.
It's well known that part of Yemeni customs and traditions is for people to gather on the first day of Eid to celebrate. The enemy exploited this and targeted the gathering, while the head of the devil, Trump, claimed it was a military meeting. The Yemeni army remains in its military barracks, safeguarding its equipment, and was not affected by this strike, which clearly targeted civilians.
Yemeni military sources quickly